Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Electrical Workers against Exelon. Mr. Sanders.
May it please the court. My name is Anthony Sanders, and I'm up here today on behalf of IBEW Local 15. Today, this case comes before this court solely on the procedural basis of the grant of a motion to dismiss. When adjudicating this case below, the district court only reviewed our complaint and the requisite documents required by statute, the arbitration award, and the collective bargaining agreement. Exelon, in its motion to dismiss, sought to attach parts of the arbitration record. However, the district court properly ignored those documents and only reviewed our complaint and the two aforementioned documents, the award and the contract. In doing so, it adjudicated this case with only a corner of the big picture. Nevertheless, it did conclude that there was no set of facts upon which relief may be granted. On our public policy claim, it did this in one solitary paragraph. The underlying arbitration concerned an oppressive work rule that was unilaterally instituted upon Exelon's union employees on one of the toughest jobs that there is, the linemen. For over 30 years, Exelon and Local 15 and its predecessor have worked to make sure that both parties work together to make sure that call-outs are responded in a reasonable manner and in a manner that in which crews are filled so the public can have its power restored at a moment's notice. In following this system, there was no disciplinary component to the call-out policy until 2003. That is when Exelon unilaterally instituted the ARCO system. There are two components to the ARCO system.
But didn't the arbitrators specifically state that the unilateral implementation of the call-out policy was within ComEd's authority under the Management's Rights Clause?
That's right, Your Honor.
So isn't this just a situation where you disagree with the result that the arbitrator came up with in terms of interpreting the collective bargaining agreement?
Well, Your Honor, we only have three claims in this matter. We do not mean to reinterpret the entire arbitration.
Right. You're focused on the call-out and
right. The
discipline.
That's right. And they, in turn, manifest disregard of the law, violation of public policy, and that the arbitrator exceeded his authority. Now, on the first two of those claims, there's been some confusion in the briefing as to whether an arbitration award may be vacated when the arbitrator did interpret the contract. An award may be vacated even when the arbitrator interprets a contract, when the award calls for a violation of the law. Now, the violation of the law that we focus our attention on in this matter is of the NLRA. Therefore, when an arbitrator orders something that would be a violation of the NLRA.
What is the violation of the National Labor Relations Act?
The sections 8A1 and 8A5, that there is a mandatory subject of bargaining, discipline, which has not been waived by the union.
Look, a conclusion that the contract already gives the management this power can't possibly be a violation of the National Labor Relations Act. It may be wrong, but it can't be a violation of the National Labor Relations Act.
Well, Your Honor,
suppose the contract said in it, management may, if it wishes, adopt a policy that workers must respond to 50% of calls or be disciplined. And management then raises its hand and say, we wish to. Any violation of the National Labor Relations Act?
That would be evidence of waiver, Your Honor.
It's not evidence of waiver. It's just evidence that the contract allows the management to do it. That's how the arbitrator interpreted the contract.
Well,
therefore, there can't possibly be a violation of the NLRA.
Your Honor, in this case, the arbitrator interpreted the contract in a backwards fashion. First, it looked
at... You disagree with it. But, of course, anybody who files a lawsuit saying, we disagree with the award, so it should be set aside, that's just sanctionably frivolous.
Well, Your Honor,
made it clear, I thought, that these public policy arguments or violation of law arguments can be made if and only if somebody wrote down in the contract the thing the arbitrator said the contract means, then the contract would be a violation of law.
Your Honor,
you agree that if this were written down in the contract, there would be no violation of law.
Well, we agree on that point. But in this case, we are at the early pleading stage of a motion to dismiss. We have not been able to bring any of the arbitration records before this court or before the district court.
Thing two, it's the whole point of arbitration is to avoid this kind of thing.
Well, the prior standards that this court has developed under that in that case law involve motions for summary judgment and appeals from that. The only time this court has affirmed on a motion to dismiss a case such as this on a to vacate an arbitration award was in Tamory, a case from 1982, I believe. In that case, the plaintiffs attached the entire arbitration record to the complaint, and this court cited to the arbitration record, cited to what was said before the arbitrator in ruling on the case. In this case, the court can't do that. It would be much better for the case to be remanded so both sides can present their evidence from the arbitration record.
Look, the arbitration record is the evidence presented to the arbitrator. You do not get, as you seem to believe, another crack in the district court. The district court can consider the collective bargaining agreement and the arbitrator's award, but anything beyond that is just completely outside the court's power.
Well, we're asking.
Everything you're saying persuades me that you're engaged in frivolous obstruction.
Well, on the regard of frivolousness, Your Honor, the other side has never made a request under Rule 11 in the district court, and on appeal now, it has made no separate motion, which is required under rules in order to impose sanctions. It has just made a mere passing reference to Dries and Crump in its response brief, which is not sufficient for a call for sanctions. Therefore, it would be highly unprecedented for this court to move in that manner when there's only one time before that this court has affirmed an appeal on a motion to dismiss to vacate an arbitration award.
Well, even if we agreed with you that perhaps you could possibly benefit from more factual development of the record, the arbitration award is still based on the collective bargaining agreement. And so ultimately, even if you had all that in the record, wouldn't judicial review still be foreclosed?
Well, as far as the arbitration award, it is, of course, within the arbitrator's discretion what the arbitrator places in the award. Therefore, the arbitrator does talk about some of the side agreements that led up to the ARCO system, but we would have the chance to supplement that. In addition, the arbitrator does speak about the Exelon having the authority to make its linemen pay for their own pagers and cell phones. That is one example. That is flatly contrary to Article 5, Section 6 of the contract. That is one example that we wish to move forward in stating that the arbitrator exceeded his authority under the contract. The question is not whether or not we will prevail. The question is whether or not we will be able to offer additional evidence to pursue our claims that have been properly pled under the liberal pleading standards of Rule 8. Now, going back
to... But now, with respect to your FLSA argument, that was not raised before the district court, was it?
Well, before the district court, we merely raised our public policy claim.
Right, and isn't that a problem because you didn't raise the FLSA claim?
Well, FLSA would be something we would argue under the public policy claim going forward.
How?
Your Honor, we...
If the award means that your workers are on call 24 hours a day, then the FLSA means that they're entitled to a bonanza in pay. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the award.
Well, it would mean
you
that the...
embracing the award and saying, our clients just got rich.
Well, Your Honor, the award discusses the areas of overtime and of pay for overtime. And therefore, that would be something that in the award mandating this system or allowing the company to pursue this system, it would allow for a violation of the FSLA in not paying overtime while engaged to be waiting.
Well, that's what's before Judge Kaur in the class action case, right?
That's right, Your Honor. And the union is not a party to that case. That is being brought on behalf of over 300 linemen who feel that their rights under the FSLA have been violated by Exelon's behavior. That case, incidentally, just made it past the motion to dismiss and before Judge Court.
Well, I'm still having trouble with why you get around the fact that you didn't bring the FLSA claim in the complaint or in response to the defendant's motion to dismiss, why we should even look at it.
Well, the complaint is what we are reviewing today, and in that complaint we do make a case for a violation of public policy and a manifest disregard of the law.
But you make no reference to pay or lack of pay at all.
You
directed toward the arbitration award and whether it should be vacated in
right.
light of the discipline that
and
was imposed.
And in the arbitration award, not allowing for pay when the men are engaged to be waiting, then it would be a violation of public policy if that violated the FSLA. The NLRA claim was pled.
I still don't comprehend your answer. How does the award violate the Fair Labor Standards Act?
Because
the Fair Labor Standards Act requires pay. It does not set standards for when people can be on call. If a hospital says to its physicians, you're on call 24 hours a day, there's no violation of the FLSA, although they may have to be compensated. So where's the violation of the FLSA?
The violation of the FSLA is in the award. It does not state that these men need to be paid.
Awards don't state the pay consequences. The question that was being arbitrated was whether this was a valid demand by Exelon.
Well,
they also don't state that when the linemen respond to these calls, they're not allowed to exceed the speed limit.
Well, the arguments for that about wages and hours and what was presented before the arbitrator is something that is not in the record. And is, again, something that we wish to pursue on remand, and able to be developing what was stated in the arbitration. Your Honor, I'd like to reemphasize that whether or not there is a mandatory disciplinary system is a mandatory subject of bargaining. That is something that has to be bargained unless there is waiver. Now, there was only waiver found, there was no waiver found in this case under what the arbitrator's interpretation of the contract. There is merely the arbitrator stating that there is nothing in the contract that forbids Exelon from instituting this system. That is backwards of the way it's supposed to work. It's supposed to be that you cannot institute a mandatory subject of bargaining without bargaining unless there is waiver, and then you proceed to the next step. That is something that the arbitrator and Exelon, in seeking to uphold the award, misinterpreted.
You're into your rebuttal time, in case you...
Thank you, Your Honor. Based on the limited record, the district court should be reversed, as the plaintiff has adequately stated a cause of action to vacate an arbitration award, and we should be given a chance to develop the case before the district court.
Mr. Sanders, Mr. Montgomery.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Montgomery on behalf of the defendant appellees in this matter. Your Honors, I would like to address two points to the court this morning. First, that the arbitration award does comply with this court's review of arbitration awards, and that it's clear that this arbitrator interpreted the contract. And second, that the arbitrator's determination of the call-out program that it was authorized by the collective bargaining agreement is necessarily determinative of the National Labor Relations Act issues that my opposing counsel just referenced. Regarding that first point, this court has made it clear time and time again that when an arbitrator interprets a contract, that is all that is what is required. This court fairly recently stated in Wise versus Wachovia that the issue was not whether or not the arbitrator got it right, that the issue was whether the arbitrator interpreted the contract. The court went so far as to say that it doesn't matter if the interpretation is incorrect or even wacky. That's the same language that the Supreme Court said in the Garvey case. Whether or not it was incorrect or silly, it doesn't matter. The key is, did the arbitrator interpret the contract? Here, there can be no doubt that the arbitrator interpreted the contract. Right at the outset of his analysis, this arbitrator, page 32 of the award, focused immediately on the Management Rights Clause, Article 2 of the contract. And he made it clear that the direction of the working forces under that clause are vested in the company unless otherwise specifically provided in the agreement. And then in focusing on that, and based on his interpretation, he then found, as Your Honor referenced, authority for the call-out program and Commonwealth Edison's disciplinary component within that Management Rights Clause. In addition to interpreting that particular Management Rights Clause, he then went on to then look at the other pertinent provisions of the contract as referenced by Local 15 in their complaint and found that there was no conflict with those provisions with the Management Rights Clause. His interpretation, based on the Supreme Court, certainly based on the many decisions of this court, is entitled to deference. As the second point that I would like to address, Your Honors, I just heard again how this award is in violation of the National Labor Relations Act, that it's against public policy, that it's against the waiver provisions that the National Labor Relations Act and the board decisions have discussed. Again, as a matter of law, that argument fails. It absolutely fails because, as determined by the arbitrator, the company here, in fact, actually did engage in bargaining. It engaged in bargaining when it initially entered into the collective bargaining agreement when it had that management rights clause. And that management rights clause gave it the authority to implement the ARCO's call-out program. The National Labor Relations Board has been clear. In many cases cited to this court, the Smurfit Stone case, the Southern California case, the Denison case, that when an arbitrator finds for unilateral authority by a company within a management rights clause, it has satisfactorily addressed the National Labor Relations Act bargaining issues. And a specific finding of waiver, a specific finding of a clear and unmistakable waiver, is not necessary. They have said that repeatedly.
The Local 15's argument, as I understand it, is that unions can never lose arbitration. Only employers can lose arbitrations.
Right.
Because any time the union loses, that violates the National Labor Relations Act because the arbitrator has reached a position the union doesn't agree to.
Yeah, that certainly seems to be the case, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, I think that they reference that in their brief when they claim that, for example, sanctions, which we are not asking for, by the way, but they said that, well, unions can't be sanctioned because they have a duty of fair representation right, which I certainly don't agree with. I don't think that the standard is any different for unions than companies when it comes to having arbitration review.
Turning to their FLSA argument, do you think it's significant at all that the employees don't seem to know in advance that they'll be on call? You know, employees in other jobs may know what days they're on call, but here they seem to always be at risk of being on call, don't they?
I don't, Your Honor. In fact, if I may, can I address your question in two parts? I think the first part is that my opposing counsel referenced that Fair Labor Standards Act claim was properly before the court because they just said generally that there was a public policy argument in their complaint. That's not true. Their complaint alleges public policy, and it specifically alleges something about public policy. It says that the public policy is violated based on the National Labor Relations Act. It doesn't say anything about the Fair Labor Standards Act. So I do think it's inappropriate for them to be raising that argument here. But nevertheless, in terms of your question, I don't think that there's any violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Yes, certainly employees are subject to being on call. It's very clear from the award, though, that they're not required to accept every call. As the arbitrator pointed out, there's plenty of flex in the system. They don't even get into the discipline threshold unless they get, you know, five calls in a particular quarter. They only average about, you know, four or five calls in a quarter. There's an exception process. And I think that this court, again, has been very clear in Fair Labor Standards Act cases. The Dingus case comes to mind, and other cases that, you know, some type of adjustment of their behavior away from work does not render them engaged to wait. So I think that that claim, and that's what they're alleging in their appellate brief, that they had to adjust their behavior, that in and of itself is something where their claim fails as a matter of law. One of the things before I leave the second point I wanted to address, I think that the Smurfit Stone case is one that I would urge the court to look at because, you know, that case is very similar to our case here. It's a case where Smurfit Stone unilaterally adopted an attendance program. The union claimed, hey, you have to bargain with us about it. The arbitrator looked at the management rights clause, which is nearly identical to the one that Commonwealth Edison has in the collective bargaining agreement. And ultimately, the National Labor Relations Board said, you know, look, when the arbitrator finds authority under the clause, under that management rights clause, that arbitrator definitively resolves the National Labor Relations Act bargaining issues, and no specific waiver is necessary. For those reasons, we ask this court to affirm the decision of the lower court, and unless there are any further questions, that concludes my remarks.
I just have just one question. It is unusual that a case like this would be decided on a motion to dismiss, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think that you raise a good point. I think the key here is their complaint, okay? They didn't have a vague and ambiguous complaint. They had a very, very specific complaint. They specifically referenced what aspects of the law were violated, what aspects of the National Labor Relations Act. They said that in the complaint, what the pertinent contractual articles are relevant to the dispute, and they attach the pertinent provisions of the contract. They put a fence around their complaint that made it ripe for the district court to properly dismiss the case. And nowhere in that did they, you know, raise these other things such as, you know, we really need the side agreement, so we need to look at the Fair Labor Standards Act. I think further evidence of that is if you look at their response to the motion to dismiss, they're staying within the confines, obviously, of the fence that they put around their complaint. They don't mention the significance of, you know, anything else beyond the pertinent provisions of the contract that they attached. And if you look at those contractual provisions and you look at the award and you apply it to the law, it becomes a pure legal argument. So therefore, I don't think it's unusual for a court to grant a motion to dismiss in this context. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Montgomery. Anything further, Mr. Sanders?
Just a couple of very quick points. First of all, counsel raises your attention to Smurfit Stone and Southern California Edison. As we stated in our reply brief, there's a further opinion in the LRB, Kohler Mixed Specialties, which states that a finding that a contract allows an employer to act in a certain manner does not amount to a finding that the employer has acted lawfully. This again points out the distinction between interpreting the contract and allowing for a violation of the law. I'd also state that the management rights clause in this case is a very particular management rights clause. Prior case of this court, Chicago Tribune of 1992, in that management rights clause, there was a statement that the company has the right to implement reasonable work rules. This kind of management rights clause does not do this. This management rights clause also does not blanketly state the company has the right to implement discipline. It merely states a few powers that the company has, but it is not broad and far-reaching. That's all I have, Your Honor, and Your Honors, and we again ask that the case be remanded to district court so we can supplement our record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders. The case is taken under advisement.